And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2557. And before Teresa gets going, we're going to discuss the language in this bill and the conceptual amendment language is going to be talked about in a minute. What we're not going to talk about are court cases and old court cases and grievances and who and what we hate and all that stuff. So let's keep it contained to the language we have and the language you're going to be briefed on, and I believe there's a handout for that, and I apologize for it not being here today. But with that, Teresa, would you please... Oh, and one more thing. Representatives Esquivel and Berger have a bill in transportation, and then they have a meeting after that, and then they'll be here after they're done. And Representative Smith is excused for the day. So go ahead, Teresa, please.
Okay, certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2557 exempts certain public-private projects and certain affordable housing projects from the requirements of prevailing wage laws. Under the bill, a project that is exempt has certain criteria listed in the bill. It includes being privately owned, in which no more than 25% of the completed project square footage will be occupied or used by a public agency, and for which no more than $750,000 of a public agency's funds are used. The measure also exempts a residential construction project that is privately owned and predominantly provides affordable housing.
Did I ring in a public hearing?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. All right, then. I would like Jessica Adamson and Bob Shiprack, please. Jessica, if you're ready, go right in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're a trade organization representing commercial contractors in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And we're here today in favor of House Bill 2557 with some agreed upon amendments between myself and Mr. Shiprack. Has also asked to share with the committee that the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and NECA are also in favor of this legislation. I believe a handout is being passed out, a three-page document that says House Bill 2557, Substantive Clarification Amendments. The bill as written doesn't quite do what we had intended for it to do, and so with the chair's indulgence, we'll walk through what the substance of these amendments will do once they're back from council. What it would do does several things, but the first thing it does is deal with this whole issue of public-private partnerships. And it would do essentially two halves of the whole. The first half is to create an exemption from prevailing wage for projects that are privately owned, have private funds involved, involve less than $750,000 in public funds and are less than 25% occupied by a public agency. On the flip side of that, the amendments would also clarify that if a project is privately owned, privately funded, and is either 25% occupied by a public agency upon completion of the building or has more than $750,000 in public funds involved in the construction, that it is subject to prevailing wage. And the agreement on the 25% of completed floor space is that determination about whether there's that floor space involved, so whether prevailing wage applies or not, is made prior to the start of the construction. So, again, this is in an instance where there are less than $750,000 in public funds involved, but 25% or more of the floor space of the completed building at the time construction begins or prior to the start of construction will be occupied or used by a public agency in a private building with private funds that would be subject to prevailing wage. The second portion of the bill deals with affordable housing. And Mr. Shiprack could probably walk through what that language means a little better than I could, so I will leave that to him, but hit the other two pieces before I do that, if that's okay. Another portion of the bill that will be dealt with in the amendments has to do with divisibility of these projects. One of the things that, as we've worked on this issue throughout the interim, that became clear and is currently, I believe, a policy of the Bureau, is if you can look at a public-private partnership project, and if there are a portion of the project that is clearly involves public funds and a portion that does not, then you separate that project into two parts, and you make prevailing wage subject to the part with public funds, and you do not make it subject to the part that does not have public funds involved. So, for instance, if you have a local government say, hey, I'll help you build the parking structure for this many-story office building, they'll bring in new jobs. The office building is privately funded. The parking structure involves public funds. What we would require in this bill is if you can divide those two structures, that the part with the public funds involved is subject to prevailing wage. The office building that has no public funds in it would not be subject to prevailing wage. And this is currently occurring. We believe it's a good practice. We believe it's fair. And so the bill will contain language that specifies that that should happen. Finally, there is a clarification on the issue of public funds. Oregon statute goes through and lists what are not public funds, and that happens in Section 1 of the bill. This the bill currently requires and will retain the requirement that public funds are not tax abatements or tax credits for purposes of figuring out prevailing wage. So if some company is going to come into an area, they're going to get a property tax credit or exemption. That is not considered public funds for the purpose of determining are there public funds involved in the project. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Shipwreck to talk about what the affordable housing piece is, but want to share with you that we are in support of this legislation that we believe is very necessary to clarify what is a very complex problem that has taken a lot of time and a lot of effort. As you can tell by the number of folks sitting behind me, this is a pretty important issue to a lot of folks, including construction contractors who find themselves in the middle of these issues. If it isn't decided up front or someone decides halfway into the project, yeah, it should have been subject to prevailing wage, we're stuck at that point, too. And so we believe clarity is good for everyone, and we believe that these amendments get us there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. A little bit of background, if the chair will indulge me for just a second, a little bit of history of how we got here I think is important for the committee. The Labor Commissioner appointed a task force well over a year ago to try and work out an arrangement on how public-private partnerships would be treated under the law. The reason this is such an important issue is because in contracting, in Jessica and our world, things evolve, things change. We bid things differently now, and the problem is in 1959 when Governor Hatfield signed the prevailing wage law in Oregon, nobody had ever heard of a public-private partnership. The statutes were designed for roads and schools and state office buildings, not some of the creative things that we see today in public contracting. So I should also mention Oregon's not the only state wrestling with this. This is going on all over the country because it's obviously public-private partnerships are utilized nationally. And in other states, their legislatures have ruled on this. I should mention that the genesis of this bill was blatantly copied from legislation passed by the California legislature 2 years ago, with a few exceptions. It's pretty similar to what the California legislature has passed. The task force that the commissioner put together really kind of fell apart, and it was nobody's fault. It took me a while to analyze why that happened, and I came to the realization that you got two issues here. One is housing, and one is commercial. And we had this room full of really smart people, and the housing people would talk about one thing, and that had nothing to do with the commercial developers. And conversely, the conversations we're having with people that are building 30-story high-rises had nothing to do with somebody building a 12-unit affordable housing project. So we kind of just disbanded, and then some of us went to the Portland City Council. We spoke to the mayor's office, and Mayor Potter at that time asked the Portland Development Commission to hold hearings and come up with at least a wage policy for the city of Portland and PDC, who spends about $250 million annually on construction, much of which has already prevailed, but a lot which is not. Those discussions have concluded. I guess I can say they have adopted a wage policy at PDC and the city of Portland. The details, I think, are still being worked on, and there's a gentleman here that can talk to that. After the task force disbanded, however, I really took it upon myself. I was really troubled by testimony that the affordable housing people had delivered at our task force, and luckily two people are here that I hope will be testifying today representing the affordable housing community. And so I went to them. I'm a officer in a community development corporation. We've built affordable housing. I know something about it. And I was very troubled by their concerns about prevailing wage, and met with them, shared with them this idea I found from California, and spent many months working with the housing people to fashion what's in the bill. The intent of this bill, and I would resist efforts by some people who have already tried to say, well, let's change this and change that. I want a bright line standard so anybody here could determine based upon this legislation whether a project, be it commercial or a housing project, whether prevailing wages should apply or not. Jessica's talked about the commercial side. The housing side is equally clear. In affordable housing, a threshold issue is what is the housing being built for based upon income levels. That is what the contracts are all about. That's how you get your money. That's what the city or county is desiring. And so what the bill says, starting on line 6, it defines affordable housing and where this would be exempted from federal Davis-Bacon HUD rates, and I'll talk more about that later, is that if the housing is being built at 60% of area median income, and that means a lot to anybody in the housing community, or if the occupants are owners whose incomes are no greater than 80% of their area median income, the project would be exempted from the state residential rates, which are the same as the federal HUD residential rates, which I'll explain, and predominantly means 60% or more. It also goes on, privately owned includes housing provided on real properties owned by a public agency if property-related structures are leased to a private entity for 50 years or more. Again, a threshold issue in Oregon that means a lot to the housing people. We go on to define residential. It's the same definition found in federal statutes, so we're going to be consistent. We know what the residential means. So a very clear, bright line that would describe what is covered and what is not covered by these rates. I should say when residential, with the exception of the city of Portland, is 4 stories or less. In Portland, they have a different code that allows 5 stories. It's the only jurisdiction I'm told that allows 5 stories. So it would be 5 stories in the city of Portland. The PDC adopted the resolution that we came together with the housing folks. That's part of their wage policy, and the bill mirrors very, very closely what the Portland Development Commission and the City of Portland have adopted. I got some handouts, and I'm going to be very brief, but one of the problems that I've discovered, and I've been working on this issue for a long time, and there's a lot of people behind me that I think have some misconceptions about what prevailing wage is. And it's an issue that I keep struggling with, and I clearly have failed in explaining how this law, how did it get here, what it really is. And it's not the end of civilization as we know it. A lot of projects, about 50% of the construction dollar in this state is under prevailing wages already. I mean, that's how we build most things. But in no particular order, I do have some handouts that I wanted to just very briefly touch on. I hope you'll look at it. The first, and perhaps the housing people will expand on this, but in the course of the discussions with the housing folks, we wanted to try and work collaboratively, and, you know, how can we make this process work better? And one of the people at the table had what I thought was a novel idea and something maybe other groups should examine instead of coming to the legislature. And Martha's comment was, why do we have to legislate everything? Why can't we just agree to some basic principles and both sides live to them? And I said, well, I have no problem. So we have a memorandum of understanding signed by the affordable housing people and the building trades that says just basically that we're going to work together if we believe there's a contractor on one of their projects that is perhaps paying cash, and that's become a big problem in our industry right now, or there's no workers' compensation being paid, that they would assist us and go out on the job sites and actually get the information, and if indeed true, turn it over to the appropriate state agencies. Conversely, we have pledged to assist them in affordable housing, getting more affordable housing in the state. It's jobs for us, and frankly, there's a synergy between labor and the housing people that we intend to build on. The second thing is this is a vote count from Measure 12, 1994. This was when there was an initiative to repeal the state's prevailing wage law. It failed. In every single county in the state, it went down by a margin of statewide of 64%. I just completed some recent polling, and that number still statewide is at 64%. Interestingly enough, in the metro area, it has went up as far as public support for prevailing wage. The next thing I want to show you, a lot of people I've never looked at this document, and these are what are known as the federal Davis-Bacon HUD rates. These are the wage rates that are required to be paid on residential housing. The Labor Commissioner has adopted these rates, and I want you to just take a look at those rates by county. Some of them have to be adjusted to make up for Oregon's minimum wage. Many of these rates have not been updated since 1979. And if these rates are going to drive all the business out of Oregon, I guess we got a real big problem. But these are the rates we're talking about, Mr. Chairman. For construction, electrician here in Deschutes, Jefferson County, $14.60 an hour, no fringes. Carpenters at $7.13. Laborers at $5.45. Well below Oregon's minimum wage. But those are the rates that we're talking about in the affordable housing.
Not what a legislator makes.
About that. So that's what we're talking about on these residential projects, that second part of the bill. The next thing is a Cockshaw report. Mr. Cockshaw was a reporter and writer for Construction Industry Issues for about 35 years. He recently retired, and I'm not going to read this. I would hope the committee does and any member of the public, but it's yet the latest study that's out. It's almost what was it, 148 pages done by the University of Missouri, I believe. Yeah, Department of Economics, University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's called A Closer Look at Wage Laws. They looked at 13 Midwestern states, some which had prevailing wage, some which did not. After an analysis of about 9 years of data of both public and private works construction, they could find, and I'll quote it here, they could not find a difference between prevailed projects and non-prevailed that were statistically significant. Couldn't find it after 9 years of research. Hope you just look at that. And I've got a lot of these studies that show this. The other thing I wanted to bring to your attention, and perhaps other folks here in the room might want to look at this, I've never seen a study like this. This was done by the National Heavy Highway Committee at the, it was done by the Construction Labor Research Council in 2004. This is kind of the standard for economics in the construction industry. They're very nonpartisan, down the middle. They just want the facts. They're a bunch of economists. And it's using federal highway statistics. And what they did is they took a look at high wage versus what's it cost to put a mile of highway down. Very simple test. And you can look at it. It's very interesting, and I just want to point this out because I'm pretty darn proud of it. I think it's the second or the last page. Oregon is a high-wage state for construction, yet we're one of the cheapest states per man-hour in putting a roadway down. You take a look at the low-wage states, they may be two, three, four times more man-hours just to accomplish that same task. So what I'm trying to say is, and what the results of this study are, is that paying high wages gives you more productivity, lowering the number of man-hours actually needed to complete the project. And in fact, you'll see if you look at it, a comparison of high-wage versus low-wage states, actually, when you look at how much roadway is completed, it's cheaper in a high-wage state than a low-wage state. Texas was my favorite. The last thing is just some handouts that I've produced. I won't go into it. Some of it's about apprenticeship. One of the largest factors in prevailing wage is it does encourage apprenticeship and training for the industry. It's a major factor for us and very important. And then you'll see the graphs on the first page of what I just described, the low-wage states and the actual costs. The last thing I'm going to talk about, we've talked about what the residential rates are that I just handed out. This is the book. I should have got you copies. But in 1995, Senator Durfler and I and some other folks, we made a major reform of the prevailing wage law. At the time, Senator Durfler wanted the prevailing wages to reflect the market wages. So Commissioner Jack Roberts at that time, myself and others, put together a program of redoing how prevailing wages, this is the state prevailing wage now, is done. There are experts from Boley here, but once a year, the Employment Department surveys about 8,000 contractors throughout the state and gets wage and hour data from these contractors. It's then put together by economists over here at the Oregon Employment Department of what the wages and fringes in 14 regions of the state are. And then they're published. And it depends on what part of the state you are. Some are union rates, many are not union rates, but that's what the results of the survey showed. I talked to Art Ayer the other day about this survey, and I said, Art's the state labor economist. I said, is what we collect market rate data? And he said, yes, it is. That's what an economist would call market rate data. So I'll close by just saying that these rates are not something that are invented somewhere. There's a lot of contractors that put the time into this to get these this data. It is not a voluntary survey. It's mandatory. Employers can get fined if they don't turn this data in, and it's done annually to adequately and accurately reflect the wages paid in the regions in the state by craft. It's what is actually the dollars that are there people that pay less? Sure there are, but it's not the majority. It's what their area standard wages and fringes are, and that's what we call it. So I just wanted to mention that, and I hope the little primer I've given gives both the committee and some of the opponents of the prevailing wage some facts that they can kind of chew on that what we're trying to accomplish. And the reason why we want to do this, I've already mentioned it, it enhances the apprenticeship. I just want to tell you, it's a funny thing coming from a union guy, but to me, one of the biggest advantages of these prevailing wage laws is that it helps ensure that local contractors and local workers are working on the projects. You go by any ODOT project, see how many out-of-state license plates there are. Very, very few. I mean, that's the intent of the bridge program that ODOT put together that many of you voted on. 99% of all those contracts went to Oregon contractors, and that's a pretty good thing. It's money that's local, goes right back into the economy, employs local construction people, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here. And I'll stop.
Any questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Jessica, going back to your testimony, the provisions about tax credits and tax abatements not counting as public funds, currently, are they counted as public funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, my understanding is that they are not considered to be public funds today, but there's been a great deal of concern about whether they are, whether they will be, what, how the Bureau treats those. I believe Bowley would be able to provide you a more clear answer, but it's my understanding that they are not, and because of the level of concern, putting it in the statute appeared to be the way to resolve many of those issues.
Thanks.
Anything Mr.
else?
Chair, if I
yes.
may add on at the back end, Mr. Shipwreck talked a lot about what benefits he sees from prevailing wage, and if I may share with you why AGC supports prevailing wage in the way it does. Oregon has a low bid competitive bidding system in the public marketplace. In a low bid environment, what you're trying to do is find a way to get in there and get the job. And we compete on innovation, and prevailing wages by saying here's what you'll be paying by craft in certain areas, that means that we take wages off the table in terms of what we're competing on. We're competing on innovation. We're competing on how quickly we can get the project from the plans to the end. We believe that's good for the market. It solves the union open shop going head-to-head on whether they're better or not or who's paying what. Takes that issue off the table, and we can compete on innovation. That's good for the public. It's good for the workers, and we believe it's good for the construction industry. And so that's why when we're here talking about prevailing wage as a concept, we think it's a good thing for Oregon. There's always work to do on the process, and we work on that as an industry, and we appreciate that partnership we've got with the Bureau and with Mr. Shipwreck and our other Construction Association partners. But from a business standpoint, when we're competing against each other, as we do, for the opportunity to work on these public projects, being able to compete on innovation, what we can deliver, is better in the long run for Oregon than us trying to beat each other out on wages.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Could I make one comment?
Yes, sir.
Just because Jessica reminded me of something I needed to get on the record. People talk about, you know, getting rid of it, or you'll save 30% in your costs. In the federal highway study that I showed you, they found labor costs on highway and bridge construction was 20% of the bid price. labor, raw labor costs were 20%. On the building survey, it was 21.7% were raw labor costs. So it's 20% of any project is labor costs, so it's hard to imagine these massive cost savings that people talk about. It's just mathematically not there.
Any more questions? All right, then. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Dan Gardner. And Dan, do you have some staff who'd like to come with? And then after Dan, I'm going to have a couple nice people that have signed up in opposition. And then the rest of my list is four, so we'll just keep going down that in order they came in. Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm happy to be here today to talk about House Bill 2557. You know, as a state official charged with administering and enforcing the state's prevailing wage law, I support establishing a clear and bright line for these public-private partnerships. You know, we worked hard at the Bureau to apply the PWR test to such projects in a fair and legal manner. We spent thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars on analysis of such projects. You know, when I first came into the Bureau, one of the first things I realized is that we didn't do very many predeterminations and how unfair it was, really, to find out halfway through a project, three-quarters of the way through, or toward the end that it was prevailing wage. And we've actually turned the Bureau to a predetermination agency. When we used to do about one or two predeterminations a year, we in the last biennium did over 150 predeterminations, and we completed 70% of them within 15 days, so that agencies do know up front whether a project is covered or not. You know, I feel legislation to establish this clear, bright line will really improve the situation for all parties. And when I say all parties, I mean all parties: construction workers, contractors, public agencies, BOLI, and most importantly, Oregon taxpayers. You know, to give you a little bit of context, there's 32 states that have a Little Davis-Bacon Act or a Prevailing Wage Act, and 31 of them define them as over a certain dollar threshold, whether it's a public-private partnership or a standard public works project such as a road, school, or bridge, that it's prevailing wage. Attached actually to my testimony should be a chart showing the other 31 states, and those thresholds vary anywhere from $1 to $500,000 in public funds for when the law applies. So, but unfortunately, I still feel it's necessary to once again remind the committee to place on the record, you know, some of the facts of what we've done in my administration. To give you a little bit of history, the first public-private partnership was the Salem Carousel Project in 2001. The prevailing wage law was applied by then Labor Commissioner Jack Roberts. So it wasn't the first one was not even under my administration. In September 2005, I established a task force on public-private partnerships, and I think someday perhaps Bob Shiprack and Jessica Harris Adamson will forgive me for making them co-chairs of that committee for 8 months. And they actually did a great job, and a lot of discussion took place. It really was a blue ribbon panel, and we tried to get to consensus on it and didn't quite get there. You know, some of the things that have happened over the last few years, let me give you a couple of examples of different types of projects. For instance, in the Hillsborough project, Hillsborough built a city hall and across the street built an affordable housing project, and unfortunately, I'd say they got not the best of legal advice. They did it all in one contract as one project and with specifications. And the position of the Bureau had been for decades that when one part of a project is prevailing wage, all of a project is prevailing wage. And if one part of a project is commercial rate, then all of it would be commercial rate. Knowing that that really would have hurt affordable housing on that particular project, and there is a distinct difference between residential and commercial rates, I went to the Attorney General's office and basically asked if I had the authority to split rates on that particular project in Hillsborough. And with their counsel, they said I did. And what we did was allowed that to happen. I split the project so that the residential portion paid residential rate, the commercial portion paid commercial rate, and further went on and put that permanently into Boley's rules, allowing that to happen under certain conditions where you establish separate certified payrolls, so you make sure that the appropriate rates paid on the appropriate side of the project and a couple other conditions. But that can be done permanently now. And then along came the Civic Project, which was in downtown Portland. It was where a developer, Girding Edlin, purchased a piece of property for $4.1 million, clearly fair market rate. They had a 16-story high-end condominium tower, a 5-story affordable housing project, and a 3-story underground parking garage underneath the 5-story condominium or the 5-story affordable housing project. We looked at that, and you know, before, as I said, the Bureau has never split a project before in the history of the Bureau. But when I sat down and met with the developers and with the Housing Authority of Portland and city officials, it was clear that the 16-story high-end condominium tower had not one single taxpayer dollar in it. Now, clearly, the affordable housing project was owned by the Housing Authority of Portland and had taxpayer dollars in it. So, again, seeking advice from the Attorney General's office, if I could ever split a project, we did do that and made the 16-story condominium tower not prevailing wage, the affordable housing project prevailing wage, and further established in rules a lot of other changes as well to allow that 5-story in the future could be done at residential rate. We actually also work cooperatively with the Portland Development Commission and the Building Trades and the development earlier this year of PDC's construction wage policy. We've also taken action to broaden the prevailing wage advisory committee. You know, the advisory committee is as required by statute, and what I've done is certainly any changes we're going to make to any administrative rules or policies go before the advisory committee first. Before the beginning of last legislative session, there were some concerns about a particular rule that was being proposed, and I realized we didn't have, although we had a member of the League of Oregon County, or the Association of Oregon Counties, on the advisory committee, we didn't have a member of the League of Oregon Cities or the Community Development Corporations, AORA. I established seats for them on the advisory committee, so their voices are heard as well. And as I said, everything goes through the advisory committee. We've also amended rules to allow reference to applicable wage rates in contract bid specifications, eliminating the requirement that the actual wage rate be included in the contract bid, so they can just refer to the Boley website and not include a huge booklet with each and every one of them. We've got new rules allowing the use of the federal residential rate on residential projects, eliminating the requirement for special wage rates to be established by Boley, unless no federal rate is published, so they don't have to continue to come to us first. And finally, we've adopted rules to clarify PWR laws as it relates to construction manager general contractor projects. We've work very hard to try and make the law fair and balanced and to clarify the lines as much as we can. However, House Bill 2557, as it's to be amended, is really necessary to fully brighten that line. In conclusion, I'd really like to say that we need a lot less rhetoric regarding prevailing wage and a lot more cooperative efforts from all concerned parties. And it's my hope that with this bill, we can represent a successful example of positive cooperation. I thank you for the ability to testify and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Commissioner today? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk a little bit about the four-story standard. That's a federal standard that we're talking about meeting or matching or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it is a federal standard that talks about four stories, over four stories being commercial rate, not residential rate. What we did at the advisory committee is establish a rule that says that will be the standard unless there is a local ordinance that allows residential construction to be higher than that. The only municipality I'm aware of that does that's the city of Portland. They allow one story of commercial space with a five-story wood stick frame built affordable or housing above that. And that now would be done at residential rate according to the rules we've established.
So upon passage of this, would that preempt any further local ordinance, or would local communities still be able to change their standards and it would be okay with this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, what we're doing is actually putting that policy that we established into the statute, and it would allow any local municipality that adopts that code or standard to have that applied to them in future.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Gardner, thanks for coming up. And, I want to know if you could clarify a couple things in this House Bill 2557 for me. I'm just looking at, skipping past what public funds are, I guess, going down to the project. I'm just sort of troubled here about a particular line in here. It says when it's describing what projects, I guess on the second page, and it's a project for which no more than $750,000 of funds of a public agency are used. So by that, are you saying we have a project and we can use $740,000 worth of public funds that it wouldn't be considered a prevailing wage project in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that's exactly what it's saying. It would establish the threshold at it had to be $750 worth of public funds in order for it to be
$750,000.
Okay. Sorry about that. $750,000 worth of public funds in order for it to be considered to be a prevailing wage project. Yes.
So, and then at the same time, you could have a project that uses $749,000, and they could get an unlimited amount of tax credits and tax abatements, which is really public funds lost, I suppose, revenue that the state could probably use at some point. So I'm just wondering, we're talking about a clear, bright line to me, and I'm looking at over at this other chart that Mr. Shiprock has given us, and it just seems like, if there's public funds in it, shouldn't it? I mean, it seems like it ought to be prevailing wage given the scenario. I mean, that would be a pretty simple, clear, bright line. If there's public funds in it, used directly or indirectly, it's prevailing wage. If there isn't, it isn't. I mean, to me, that seems like a pretty bright line. And it seems like a lot of these, creative financing things are really being used so that we don't have to pay people 20% of the project, as Mr. Shiprock pointed out, to a decent wage, which helps out for our economy. And the reason I bring this particular issue up is that I am aware of some tax credits and tax abatements and public funds that the states have used to attract business and industry, which is a good thing, I suppose. But when it came time to build this distribution center down by Lebanon, they hired a contractor from Kentucky who subbed a contractor out from Southern California who brought in workers and paid half of what the prevailing wages in Oregon were. And to me, that was public funds being invested to support our economy, and we constantly hear in economic development and the business plan folks telling us, we have a lower wage or lower average income compared to the rest of the nation, and we need to focus on investing our dollars to have higher wages in the state. And so this, to me, seems like it's really going the opposite direction. And why don't we just use a bright line? Do other states use a bright line just saying, if there's public funds in it, indirect, direct, tax credits, tax abatements, that it should be prevailing wage, and end of story? Pretty simple, bright line.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, the dollars is the threshold that other states use. It is the only bright line, really, to be able to use. We have never counted tax abatements or tax credits at the Bureau. I can just give you that historic reference, which is actually then putting, you know, our policy that's been there for a number of years into statute in the bill. Whether $750,000 is the threshold, it is $250,000 above the highest any other state that has a Little Davis-Bacon Act or a prevailing wage act. That's what's negotiated out between, you know, the interested parties, and I support their negotiations.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
So I guess my question that I didn't really hear an answer to, do other states have a bright line that just basically says if there's public funds in it, it's prevailing wage? End of story.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, absolutely they do. They're the majority of the states, I believe it's 8 of them, you put $1 into the project, whether it is a standard prevailing wage project like a road, school, or bridge, or it's a public-private partnership, it is prevailing wage, end of story.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm interested in this discussion, and Representative Holby, if the world were as simple as you paint it in terms of public-private, I might be there with you, but let me, because it's in Mr. Gardner's testimony about the Salem Carousel Project, are you aware of the issues around that project, Representative Holby? A lot of volunteers raised an awful lot of money to build a carousel in our community, and it was based on what they thought the volunteer and the labor that they could get to build it that was available. And along comes Boley and says, oops, it's on a public park, it's prevailing wage. They didn't have the money, frankly. And what we're talking about is being creative and getting things done for the public benefit and trying to draw a bright line at the same time. I applaud that it would be simple to say nothing is prevailing, that isn't prevailing wage, you know, if it has any public connection whatsoever. But in the real world, that bright line is very hard to draw, and I think that's why we're here today. But I just have to mention that for every example you bring, I'll bring you another one that doesn't quite fit in the pattern. And I know, Mr. Chair, you don't want to get into this argument.
Thank you, Representative. As I laid some ground rules out earlier, and the committee's the first ones to break them.
Point us.
Once again, well, no, it doesn't. But I just want to remind everyone, we're not going to rehash every little grievance and problem and court case and issue and hypothetical in this bill. We're here to talk about, and if people don't support this bill, then that's fine. And I'm not saying if people don't want to vote for it, that's fine too. But I just want to remind folks, well, that's not what we're doing here today. And I have a lot of things I wish for that I don't get in this building. But once again, this has been negotiated. It is going to create a line. It's going to avoid a lot of problems, in my humble opinion, and then we'll go from there. So, Mr. Gardner, do you want to respond?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just mention one thing to Representative Berger's comment, is we do not count donated labor or donated materials. We never have, and we actually codified that into statute last legislative session, the Boley's policy, and put that into statute.
Very good. Any more questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I apologize if I missed this in your testimony, but do you support the amendments that were talked about in by the first panel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, absolutely I support the amendments that were discussed by Jessica Adamson and by Bob Shiprack. It will give us the clear, bright line and really save an awful lot of taxpayer dollars where we end up in situations where when we enforce a law, local municipality ends up disagreeing with us, going to court, and spending a lot of taxpayer dollars arguing over it. What we want is a bright line. Anybody can read the legislation and know where it's at.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call a couple of nice people that are here to testify in opposition. Gene Durfler and Stephen Johnson, please. And Mr. Griffler, I wish we were here talking about reducing the summer spill, something you and I would agree on. But we're not talking about that today.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to come up and testify. Steve Johnson is with the, we're sort of representing the Salem Chamber of Commerce, and Steve is the manager of the hotel that just went through the lawsuit that we're not going to talk about.
Well, let me rephrase. If there's something that is really directly applicable that will help this conversation, I understand, and that's fine. I just don't want to retry the whole case here.
Sure, so that's fine. Well, I don't give you written information. Usually I talk off the top of my head, which usually gets me in trouble. But today I thought this was pretty important, so I did write some things that I think are important for you to consider. And that is that House Bill 2557 proposes to establish certain exemptions from prevailing wage laws. With this in mind, we need a clear record that the creation is an exemption should not lead to the assumption that the opposite is true. And I think this is important to point. That is simply because the project is not subject to clear exemption does not mean the project is covered by prevailing wage laws in the first place. And I think that's an important issue that we need to make sure that there is a bright line, and that is established in this bill. To give you an analogy in the workers' compensation system, the law provides definitions as to what constitutes work subject to the system and who is the subject worker to be covered by the system. The workers' compensation law also includes certain specific occupations which are exempt from coverage. However, this does not mean that someone who is in another occupation is covered. That person still needs to be a subject worker as opposed to a self-employed or individual or independent contractor. So I think that that's an analogy that the fact that the law covers something, it doesn't mean that everything else is going to be exempt. I think it's a big mistake, from the chamber standpoint, of giving the county, the commissioner of Bureau of Labor of Industries all the rulemaking authority that this bill does in prevailing wage. It gives him particularly, in my opinion, a lot of power in this for doing the entire chapter. I think in the past, the legislature has been very sensitive about the authority that it gives the commissioner because there's a lot of other government agencies that are also involved in the work of the prevailing wage process, which includes the Employment Department, the Department of Housing and Community Services, Department of Administrative Services, to name a few. If there is one overall rulemaking authority for the entire prevailing wage law, it should consist of a commission made up of heads of the major departments involved in these kinds of decisions. Such commissions should also include representatives, I think, from the cities and counties, among others. Should you choose to move ahead with the Senate Bill or House Bill 2557, you should add a clause which makes it very clear that the creation of an exemption does not mean that everything is included. You should also remove the section which grants comprehensive rulemaking power to the commissioner, going well beyond the necessary to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish in this bill. I would encourage you to amend the statute to better define many of the terms within the prevailing wage law, which affects the concept in House Bill 2557. A clarification of what is public work would be especially important, I think, to do. So that's my testimony. I would comment a couple of things. Bob Shipwreck did mention the fact that he and I don't say we worked together, but we got along well, on the prevailing wage law back in 1995. And I think that what I was attempting to do with the bill that was introduced was to reach a market wage instead of a prevailing wage, because a prevailing wage, in my opinion, should be a market wage. I don't think there's any logical reason why it should cost more money to build a school or a highway or a building that could be done as in the private sector. And I think a perfect example is, if I could refer to what happened today in the paper, Salem built that complex with market wage. And yet, with prevailing wage, we would have had to pay another couple million dollars because prevailing wage would have applied. So prevailing wage, in my opinion, is higher than market wage. And I have no objections, and I don't expect us to pay less than market wage to anyone. I think that a good income is very important. But I don't think that a prevailing wage, in my opinion, should be above a market wage.
And I don't want to minimize the value of getting along. We need a little more of that around here, too. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson, please.
Thank you. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm with Vips Industries, Inc. I'm actually here personally representing the Salem Chamber of Commerce as a member of its board. And I'm very happy to be here speaking after Mr. Durfler. I do have a couple of different comments that I'd like to make as well, after, of course, echoing everything he said and seconding his motion. But if I might, for my own comments, say, first of all, that we want to clarify that we do oppose the bill. I want to clarify very quickly, and secondly, that we don't oppose payment of prevailing wages. And thirdly, that we certainly don't in any case oppose payment of prevailing wages on public projects. From the first dollar, frankly. I think that which Boley has submitted here through the commissioner sounds at first blush as perfectly fair and reasonable and a pretty legitimate and intelligent effort at trying to establish that clear, bright line that the commissioner speaks about in his testimony. But frankly, I think that that misses the point completely and totally. And I will cite, without arguing the case that you've referred to a couple of times, but just use as an example for illustrative purposes only the facts surrounding that case. And before doing that, I might say again that I don't observe that the issue is the payment of prevailing wages. I think the issue or the determination what those wages might be or whether it is or is not more than a working wage, I think the real issue is what is the project. And I think that one can make a determination as to what is a private project versus what is a public project very simply and easily on a very commonsensical basis without having to interject the types of patently objective standards that the commissioner has proposed, most of which, by the way, would render any project public because of the low dollar amounts. So, for example, using that case with the Salem Conference Center and the Phoenix Grand Hotel, that is the problem here is really what is a quote-unquote project. It's not whether it's a public-private partnership. That isn't a dirty word. As is indicated by the judge in her ruling on the case yesterday, that doesn't by definition mean that something in its entirety becomes a quote-unquote public project. Nor does do some efficiencies or immediate adjacency or contingency or even use of common facilities make something a public project in its entirety. And I think that's the fatal flaw with that which is presented here today by the commissioner. The real key which has been overlooked is what is the project? For example, in the Salem Conference Center project, there was one block. It was essentially divided in two with separate ownership. There were two contracts. The city paid in its entirety every dollar of the cost of construction for the conference center. The private party paid every single dollar of cost of construction of the hotel. Two separate contracts, two separate administrations and supervisions of the construction contract. And at the end of the day, upon completion, those two separate projects are maintained in their separate ownership, one entirely public, the other entirely private. There could be nothing clearer. In my mind and in our view as the chamber, that is a public-private partnership, again, not a dirty word. There is a public component for which prevailing wages were paid. That project, by the way, represented about $32 million in a construction budget. And there was a private component for which prevailing wages were not paid, and that represented about $18 million in a construction budget. So we think that that illustrates perfectly the case here. We need to have clarification as to the fact that projects, a term of art, can contain and represent separate and distinct public and private components without contamination, using that word probably improperly, of the entire development as a public project to which prevailing wages apply. I don't think there is the need for the standards. Who cares whether it's 25%? 100% of the, well, in this, in my my method, 100% is of the conference center is public. One doesn't even have to go to 25%. One doesn't have to address the issue of $75,000, $500,000, $1. Prevailing wages should be paid from the first dollar of the public component, and prevailing wages should not be forced or mandated upon any dollars in the private project. So that's our position, and we think that those public-private partnerships are the key elements to the revitalization of the most jurisdictions within the state with the urban renewal increment financing tool that is available to us here in the state of Oregon. And without these kinds of devices, which are not creative financing, they're very simple, a private component and a public component working together for the betterment of the community, we're not going to see that kind of development and redevelopment that we have been seeing to date. Last comment, and that would be our position with respect to the rulemaking authority delegated to the commissioner. With all due respect, we oppose that, and we oppose that, again, using this particular case as a poster child for that. There are perfectly reasonable people on the commissioner's side, perfectly reasonable people on the city of Salem side. They disagreed. There had to be a check and a balance, providing the opportunity for the city of Salem to address its grievances. They did through the courts and the judicial system, and the case fell out as it may, fortunately, we think, on the side of the city. But the point is, there needs to be a check and a balance. Delegation of the sole and exclusive rulemaking authority to the commissioner would remove that check and balance for the benefit of the other jurisdictions. Excuse me, jurisdictions. Again, there are keys in this legislation of use of the words indirectly used, public funds, a project. If the commissioner is entitled to develop the definitions of those terms, there won't be a fair playing field for reasonable differences of opinion about what constitutes a public project.
Yeah,
I think that's it. Any questions?
Just to point out, had this law that we're working on today passed, that lawsuit would have been lost to the city of Salem.
And I wouldn't have anywhere to stay tonight. I spoke at the conference center today, too. But that being said, any questions for these gentlemen? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for allowing us to come up.
All righty then. I'm going to have ask Bruce Warner, please. And does your staff, Mr. Jackley, need to come with you? Okay. And well, Steve Buckstein, too, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Warner, the Executive Director of the Portland Development Commission. Portland Development Commission is the urban renewal agency for the city of Portland, and we're pleased that the committee is considering House Bill 2557 today. And I think, as you've heard, There's a need for a bright line in terms of what constitutes a delineation between public works projects and public private projects, which are for the most part constructed by private industry and private individuals, but receive some sort of public support. So we're pleased that the committee is taking us on. Overall, I want to say for the record right up front that I, our commission, and the city council are very supportive of 2557 because it does create the bright line. As you heard earlier from the labor commissioner and Mr. Shiprack, there was a failed effort in terms of trying to deal with prevailing wages on a statewide basis because it was really looking at the existing laws rather than looking at what could be done by changes in the legislation. As a result of that, what I've provided you is a little bit of history because shortly after that committee failed, our commission did do a lot of work with stakeholders to come up with its own construction wage policy in which we decided at some certain level of funding, no matter whether the project was publicly owned, privately owned, privately constructed, or publicly constructed, at some level of funding, that project should pay prevailing wage. And if you turn to page 2 of my testimony, the bullets up on top, what I would say is our wage policy determined that at the level of $1 million, is what we said. At that point, no matter whether it's a $1.5 million project or $40 or $100 million project, if there's $100 million worth of PDC resources, that project should pay prevailing wage. We also were very thankful that Mr. Shiprock could work with the building, with the affordable housing community and come up with an agreement that, that you see in the bill that's before you today. And we also agreed that that should be a consideration in our wage policy. But we knew also until this law was passed or a law was passed actually codifying this, we would not be able to actually enforce that portion of our policy. And if when I look at your bill, you've set the limit at $750,000. Again, I don't care whether it's $750,000 or $1 million. The important thing is to set that bright line for the purposes of where what is the trigger for prevailing wage. The two last bullets on that page, and the first part of that page I would call your attention to, are things that are included in our wage policy that are not in the House Bill 2557. In our wage policy, we require a process for direct entry into the apprenticeship pools from pre-apprenticeship programs, which the intent is to encourage women and minorities to be able to find jobs and careers in the construction workforce. And then we are also going to require affirmative action reports from the unions and non-union sources of labor, including contractors and subcontractors. So when I look at your bill, overall your bill addresses the main concern of establishing a bright line. And what we would suggest that if you are going to be working on this bill, that you may want to look at making sure that women and minority and the utilization of women and minorities in the construction workforce are encouraged. And I did provide copies of you with attached to this our overall wage policy, which defines what we are attempting to do. And I've also suggested that there's some things you could add to the bill if you're going to look at this that would help encourage that and assure that women and minorities have equal opportunity to the dollars made available for these projects. And the last thing I would say is if you're also going to be looking at this bill, I agree with some of the previous speakers. I would add as much clarity as you can in this bill in terms of things like what is a public resource or public funds and try to eliminate as much need and opportunity to create administrative rules so that we're not, again, having court cases that deal with what the administrative rules say versus what the law says. The final thing I would say is that the final attachment is a letter from the mayor and city council which outlines their support for this bill at the $750,000 level, as I indicated earlier. So unless you have questions, that will conclude my testimony.
I'll stay there. We might. Okay. Mr. Buxton, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. My name is Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a public policy research organization based in Portland. I'm here today because I think the discussion here falls directly within our mission, which is to foster policies that improve or increase individual liberty, personal responsibility, and economic opportunity in Oregon. I'm not going to read my prepared testimony. I handed you copies. But I really am a little bit confused. I've listened to the testimony here, and I listened to Bob Shiprock tell you, and I've heard him say this before, that the prevailing wage really is the market wage, and there's a lot of data to prove that. If that's true, can you hear me all right? If that's true, I don't know why we're all here today. Exempting certain public-private partnerships and low-income housing won't make any difference if the wage rate is the same. I think the reason we're here is that we really all know, maybe we don't want to admit it, but that they are different, that prevailing wage really is significantly higher than the market rate. And the reason that you're looking at exempting these projects, and I support exempting the projects, is that when you can pay market wages on, say, low-income housing projects, you can build more low-income housing units than you could if you had to pay prevailing wage. Otherwise, why would we be here? If someone can answer that, I'd appreciate it, because it really is sort of confusing. And I think prevailing wage, we talk about the surveys that go out, and they're mandatory, and people actually write down what the wages are, and I could go into the mathematics of it. I won't bore you with that, but it's designed really, in my opinion, to lead to a wage that is above the market. And again, otherwise, why would we be here? You can't maximize both economic goals at the same time. In one case, you have, and I think public policy has a goal to to maximize the taxpayer dollar, whether you're building affordable housing or a road or a courthouse or whatever. The other time, there's public policy to improve wages in Oregon, to pay good living wages, which I would support. But when you pay above market wages for any project, somebody has to pay for that. That's what's called, economists call the seen and the unseen. The benefits of a public project paying prevailing wages, you see those high-wage jobs, you can see those. You can see the building that you built, a bunch of affordable housing units or whatever. But what you don't see is the people who are worse off because of that. You could have maybe built more affordable housing projects and housed more people if you paid a market wage instead of a prevailing wage. You basically are taking money out of some people's pockets and giving it to the people who get the prevailing wage. And you never hear from the people who have the money taken out of their pocket because, in many cases, they don't even know it was taken out of their pocket. It's tax dollars, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here is public projects using public money. So, again, I think the fundamental issue here is I support exempting the classifications that you're talking about, but if I could offer a friendly amendment, I would exempt everything. And if the prevailing wage is really the market wage, what's there to worry about? Why would anyone be concerned if the two are the same? With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, we hear from people when we take the money out of their pockets every day, sir. I just wanted to share that with you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buckstein, it sounds like you're really questioning the basic premise of the prevailing wage rather than testifying on the bill.
Well, no, I'm supporting Chair Schaffler, Representative Rosenbaum. If I understand the reality, the political reality, this is the bill before you, and I would say yes if you can exempt these specific projects. I'm not talking about the specific rulemaking things, the sort of things that Senator Durfler and others are objecting to. I don't really want to get into those. I'm saying that exempting certain projects from prevailing wage is a good idea because you can build more of them. If prevailing wage is equal to the market wage, what's the point of exempting some? I mean, what would change if the two wages are the same? I don't understand.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you called on me cautiously. You know, I guess I just have to respond to your line of thinking there a little bit. You know, if everything was market-driven, I suppose, and we had no wage standards, and the previous instance I gave of contractors coming from out of state, out of area, you know, from a long ways away, and, you know, because the market says, well, we can do it cheaper by having slaves, you know, because we have no minimum wage, we now have no wage standards. You know, and maybe that seems ludicrous to you, but, you know, the fact is these wages were established to protect the economy of our community. And so if you want to throw all of that out the window so people that are working can't afford to live in your affordable low-income housing, because many of them can't at the wage rates that Bob has given us with these federal HUD rates, you know, we're going to have a whole workforce coming here from, you know, a long ways away, quite frankly. And we have minimum wage laws to try to hold standards up, and we have prevailing wage laws to do quite the same thing. And those people can go out into our communities, buy cars, buy homes, contribute to our economy. And the flip side of that is with your vision of the market, is that we would have a lot of people that couldn't afford any of those things would all be on the streets, and there's no way you're going to keep up with building affordable housing because you can exploit low-wage workers, and they're not going to be able to afford to live in the product that you're trying to build for them.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, I'm not sure if there was a question there, So what you're saying is that if you approve of this bill, you're creating slave labor for affordable housing in these public-private partnerships? Why would you support that? I don't think that's going to happen is what I'm saying. I think, again, if the prevailing wage is the market wage, which Bob Shipwreck has talked about time and time again with a lot of data, there should be no difference. Obviously, I don't want slave labor. So that's a whole other issue. You know, obviously, slavery is immoral, and we're not going to have that. We already have minimum wage laws in the state. But if you can produce more low-income housing units, for example, by paying a different rate than prevailing wage, you've better met one of your goals, building affordable housing. And you haven't really necessarily lowered wage rates if the prevailing wage is the market wage.
I'm going to make one more comment and then we're moving on. You know, you can go out and hire somebody for $5 and you can hire a skilled professional for a higher rate. I know what product you're going to get from each of them. And that's good enough. And I'm going to move on down the line for testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Warner? All right. Thank you very much. I would like to call Randall Tosh. Please. Is he here? All right. I just got a request to add him onto the list. He's not here. So I'm just going to keep moving on down the line here. Sophia McDonald, Martha McLennan, and Tracy Manning, please. Go to the restroom. I'll be right back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sophia McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations, or AOCDO. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of House Bill 2557, which would clarify when prevailing wage rates apply to privately owned affordable housing developments. AOCDO is a membership organization representing 32 community development corporations, or CDCs, across the state of Oregon, from communities such as Portland, Hood River, LaGrand, to communities in Medford, Eugene, Salem, Newport, and many other places around the state. CDCs are private, nonprofit, community-based organizations that develop housing for working families, for seniors, for veterans, and for people with disabilities. In the past 17 years, CDCs have developed over 11,000 units of housing, representing an investment of over $500 million in Oregon communities. These housing units serve over 20,000 people, about 40% of whom are children. We believe, and this is the reason that we do the work that we do, that for adults to succeed at work, for children to succeed in school, for veterans to be able to heal from their physical and emotional wounds, and for seniors to live in dignity, they must have a safe, decent place to call home. CDCs have been around in Oregon for about 17 years, and it was very rare for prevailing wages to apply for any of our projects until just a couple of years ago, when they more frequently began receiving determination letters from the Bureau of Labor and Industries stating that they were subject to prevailing wages. As Mr. Shipwreck mentioned earlier, there was no place where we could look and get a bright line about when the wages would apply and when they would not, and this really caused a lot of confusion and concern in the industry, both among our developers and among their partners. So our members began calling on us to try and find some kind of way to clarify when prevailing wages would apply and when they would not. Along with our sister organization, the Portland-based Community Development Network, we began approaching a number of parties to help us with that, including the Oregon Building Trades and Construction Council and the Pacific Northwest Council of Carpenters. And we began a series of conversations with them, which resulted in an agreement. And an agreement, a copy of that agreement is attached to my testimony. A lot of it is contained in House Bill 2557, beginning in subsection, it's small d, it begins on the second page on line 4. And this is just kind of a portion of our agreement. We're anticipating continuing to work with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Mr. Gardner and his staff, to make sure that the rest of our agreement is placed into administrative rule. So with that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to a couple of my members who can speak much more to the problems that this uncertainty had caused and kind of the details of our agreement.
Thank you. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. I'm also the Chairman of the Board of the Community Development Network. Northwest Housing Alternatives is an affordable housing developer who's been around in Oregon for over 20 years. We have about 1,200 affordable housing units in 14 counties in 86 properties. I have properties in most all of your districts. I'm still trying to get one in Bedford. We serve over 2,000 people each year, providing them with affordable housing, and the average income of those households is below $15,000 a year. As Sophia said, a few years ago we started having predeterminations come in that would suggest that the affordable housing projects were subject to the prevailing wage law. This led our industry into a lot of uncertainty. Our housing finance is fairly complex. We start by layering a number of different funding sources together. Those would include private grants from foundations or from individuals, private debt from banks and other lenders, private equity from tax credit investors. On top of that, we add public sources, which could be in the form of debt or equity, grants, different kinds of subsidies. Those would come from the federal level, from the state level, and from local governments. It typically takes our projects 2 to 3 years from the time we find the land and conceive the project until the time that it's built. One of the things that's very important for us in the early days of conceiving a project is to have predictability about what our costs are going to be. With the uncertainty that was caused by some of the predeterminations, that created some turmoil in our industry and led us to begin a path of negotiating with labor to find a way to resolve that. Another issue that's very difficult for us is based on the different size and scale of the properties that we have. At Northwest Housing Alternatives, I have properties as few as 2 units and properties as many as 144 units. One of the things that we've found with the prevailing wage issue is that the residential trades, the residential contractors in this state, are not as acclimated to a prevailing wage framework, and because of that have difficulty with the paperwork, the liabilities, and simply understanding it. When we look to find contractors for fairly small projects, $50,000 projects, in rural areas or in small properties, the prevailing wage has been complicated for them, and we've had situations where people have refused to bid on our projects. That has also been very difficult for us. With the agreement that we have with labor, fundamentally what we said was small projects would not be covered by the prevailing wage, and large projects would be covered by that. That would give us the bright line of certainty that we're looking for. And again, we intend to continue to work with labor to ensure that there are good labor practices on our projects, find ways that we can work together to support the employment opportunities that labor might have for our residents, the investment opportunities that labor might have in our projects, and to make sure that the projects that we have good quality labor practices for the workers on them.
Hello, my name is Tracy Manning. I am the Director of Housing for Central City Concern. We are a fairly active developer, primarily in Multnomah County, of housing for homeless people, primarily people with special needs, people that are disabled. I am officially one of the housing folks that Bob Shiprack spent a lot of time with in the last year. And we also represent private developers. I don't think a lot of folks think necessarily of nonprofits as private developers, but that's what we are. I am here in support of House Bill 2557 and was a proud member of the committee that helped negotiate with a number of labor folks to get it enacted. And I guess what was our experience was a project that was coming into being during this period of uncertainty during the last year, and it was a project that had been 3 years under development and was going to serve primarily homeless people, primarily special needs folks who are not working when they first come into our housing, and got within a few months of being ready to start construction when this issue sort of hit the fan, so to speak, and we had all of our funding in place. So the issue that it created for us is among these many funding sources that Martha referred to. One of them is a tax credit, and that's a federal tax credit, the low-income housing tax credit. And it's vital in communities all across the state to getting these projects done. It provides equity so we don't have to have a big mortgage so that we can house these very low-income and disabled people. Had this, we not been able to work with Commissioner Gardner, which we deeply appreciated, and had to hold up the project timeline to go and find more money, our tax credits would have hit the point where they expired. And the state of Oregon, unless they could find somebody quick to swap them out with, would have had to send them back to the feds, and it would have been a benefit that would have been lost. So we believe that it's very important to have this clarity, and I guess I would also add that we are very proud of the partnership that we came to with labor and the synergy that Bob mentioned before. I think some really great things are going to come for our projects and also for our clients out of this partnership and the work that we have yet to do together. Thanks so much for your time.
Any questions? You did such a great job. I guess there are none.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like Mr. Tosh, please. And Sean Miller, would you come on up too, please? Sorry about the confusion, Mr. Tosh. I thought you were in the audience.
Okay, I wasn't even sure we'd signed up. I'm Randall Tosh. I'm the city attorney for the city of Salem, and I'm here to state that the city is opposed to the bill in its current form. I haven't had a chance to thoroughly review the changes that have been presented today, so my testimony may not exactly fit the language here, but I think in general the shape of my testimony is unchanged.
And just so everybody knows, we're going to be having another public hearing on this, so everyone will get very much ample opportunity to go over everything, because we need to look at it too.
Okay. The stated purpose of House Bill 2557 is to adopt exemptions to two types of projects from Oregon's prevailing wage laws, one relating to public-private partnerships and one relating to affordable housing. The problem with House Bill 2557 is that it puts the cart before the horse. Oregon law requires the payment of prevailing wage for public works, as defined by Oregon law. Therefore, an exemption to Oregon's prevailing wage laws should not be adopted unless the specific type of project is a public work. House Bill 2557 presumes that public-private partnerships and affordable housing projects are, in fact, public works under current Oregon law. Because this is not the case, at least that's the position that we would submit, the legislature must first change the definition of public work to include these type of projects if it intends to adopt the exemptions. And the city of Salem is not here at this point to say that you can't do it or you shouldn't do it. We have our own version of what the policy should be, and I can give you that policy. But essentially that's a policy choice for the legislature, and we think that policy choice has to be embodied in an amendment to the definition of public work, not in the exemptions. Prevailing wage law defines public works as roads, highways, buildings, structures, and improvements of all types, the construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting of which is carried on or contracted for by any public agency to serve the public interest. The key language in this definition is carried on or contracted for by any public agency to serve the public interest. If the improvement does not fit this language, it's not a public work. Boley has recently adopted a position that the use of public money in the construction of an improvement through some form of an agreement means that the public agency is either carrying on or contracting for the improvement, even though that improvement will not be owned or even used by the public agency. We would submit that this actually is a change in Boley's interpretation of the law, and can provide you with some documentation to that effect if you'd like. In effect, Boley is attempting to expand the definition of public work far beyond what the legislature intended the definition of public work to mean. I will gloss over the court case, as you requested, but I would like to quote one section from the case to you, which is the judge's holding. The private Phoenix Grand Hotel is not a public work. Therefore, prevailing wage law does not apply. The agency developed its conference center and parking garage in cooperation with the private developer of the hotel. Both parties benefited from the synergies created by their cooperation. While this sort of development may be called a public-private partnership, that label does not make the agency, the owner, or developer of the hotel, and in no way converts the private side of the partnership, the hotel, into a public work. Now, one of the things that I would point out is that in 1992, there was a court case involving the construction of a facility to house the Oregon Public Broadcasting System, and it was a build-to-suit lease. The trial court held that the build-to-suit lease, at that time, the definition only used the language carried on, and Boley came to the legislature to request the addition of the words contracted for to the definition of public work. And the reason they came to the legislature is because the trial court had said carried on doesn't cover build-to-suit leases. Therefore, if you want to include those kinds of projects within the definition of public work, you need to change the definition. And Boley did what it should have done. It came and requested a change to the definition of public work. If you look at that court case, and you have to really understand the definition, one of the things that the case notes is that Boley had come to the legislature on two separate occasions and requested a change to the law that would make public funding in and of itself the sole criteria for turning a project into a public work. And the court noted that the legislature had rejected that position twice. So the current state of the law is that public funding does not make a project a public work. That's the state of the law. House Bill 2557 would add an exemption to Oregon's prevailing wage law for a project that is, one, privately owned, two, where no more than 25% of the square footage of the project will be used or occupied by a public agency, and three, that is partially built with public funds totaling no more than $750,000. We believe that Boley would most likely use House Bill 2557 to claim that prevailing wage must be paid on both the public and private portions of any public-private partnership that does not fit the criteria. And that is directly contrary to the judge's holding in the Conference Center case that was decided on Tuesday. We believe that properly viewed in light of the Marion County Court's decision and the test that a court would apply in interpreting the terms of the statute that is going to go to the floor of the legislature, that House Bill 2557 will very likely be interpreted to require the payment of prevailing wage only on the public part of the project. So that if you want to ensure that it covers both the public and private side, you're going to need to amend the definition of public work. Because courts will bring a number of tools to what you do, and as an attorney, I'll bring a number of tools to my job to try to get the court to take one side or the other. And if you want to make that change, and certainly as legislators, you know, you have the power. That's your job, is to make a change in public policy. Then you can do so. But you should do so the right way, which is through a change to the definition of public work. The final thing that I would like to note is that Section 3 of House Bill 2557 states that the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry shall adopt rules necessary for the administration of Oregon's prevailing wage laws. If a court looks at this provision of the code, the ORS, the court will look to the text and the context, and it will apply ordinary dictionary definitions in interpreting what you intended to do here. Webster's defines administration as the management of its affairs, and because the use of the term administration in this section, we believe that House Bill 2557 does not give the Boley Commissioner any additional authority to determine what the specific terms in Oregon's prevailing wage laws mean through administrative rulemaking, but only to adopt rules having to do with Boley's processes and procedures. We unfortunately have not been at the table. No one has contacted us and asked us to work with them towards any resolution of these issues. But the city of Salem is reasonable, and we're certainly willing to sit down and work with people to try to come up with something that represents a fair version of the law, and one that attorneys across the state can look at and know how to advise their clients.
Thank you, Sean.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors, and kind of reserve our position until we actually see the language, but I would like to just go off the substance of the amendments, the document that you have before you. I will say that, you know, I have been involved in the interim with this discussions. We have, as well as the PDC work group process to develop their wage guidelines. And I will say that it's a bright line has been important, I think, for our members. You know, litigation and court cases that we're not supposed to talk about today are something that's not in the best interest of my members. We don't, you know, we want to avoid those things. And so, you know, bright line is something that we would we're very interested in. You know, as for the details of the proposal, I will say that on the divisibility on the second page is something that we've always have put out there and proposed, because I think it is important to look at these projects and give the commissioner the ability to divide the projects. And if they are able to divide the project, some of the examples that actually you've heard today, you know, we would be fine with dividing public projects, for instance, the parking garage example on your sheet here, and fully privately projects, and keep them separate in the prevailing wage application. So, you know, that's something that we've always been supportive of. As for some of the language on the actual threshold, $750,000 or the 25% of the completed floor space, you know, occupied by the public agency. One of the things I want to be clear in when we actually write that particular language is that that is at the start of construction of the project, because I don't want to get us into a situation where a developer may have 20% of the project occupied by a public agency going in, and then 2 months down the road they needed an extra 6% of the project, and then how do you go back? And I understand Boley would enforce it now currently on the start of the project. And so if you move in folks, they're not going to go back retroactively. And because the contractor's jointly and severally liable for those prevailing wages, if it was a private project at the time because it was under this threshold, I wouldn't want a circumstance where all of a sudden we got to go back and pay prevailing wage retroactively. And so I just want to be clear that and I know Jessica and Bob also reference that's at the start of the construction project, that when you trigger that threshold. But I think it's clear that we're in there. If you're going to have language of bright lines, I don't want to create other unintended consequences. And so I just want that to be on the record. And the last thing, Mr. Chairman, I think that I want to distinguish the differences is the subsidies versus economic development. And, you know, I was, when we testified before the PDC, I think it was important when you're defining a subsidy for the use of what is considered public funds under this 750 threshold, that it not include the tax credits or tax abatements. You know, those are programs that are economic development programs, whether they're enterprise zones to attract businesses, which are guaranteeing certain, you know, amount of wages that they're going to be paying, plus health care. I mean, these are businesses that are being attracted to an area. And so I want to be clear, and I know the bill has tax credits, tax abatements not included in there, but as I heard the discussion, and I understand the agreement's been to you know, exclude that from that definition. But that's a very important thing that we want to distinguish, and it's very important to be in the bill that that tax credits and tax abatements are not part of that threshold. And so, you know, with that, Mr. Chair, I reserve our right as we see language. I just kind of wanted to get those some of those issues on the record, and I'm looking forward to working with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you, Jim. I'd like to call Willie Tiffany, Julian Bruce, and Randy Tucker, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. With me today is Jillian Bruce, an attorney at the Herring Long Law Firm, and she is here to bail me out of any technical questions should you have them. But I can be pretty brief on our position and sing along with the choir here that you've heard of. There has been obviously a lot of confusion around these projects and a lot of litigation around these projects. And to the extent that House Bill 2557
tries to draw that bright line that folks have talked about, the League of Oregon Cities is certainly supportive of that concept. We agree that clarification, at the very least, of which projects apply and are subject to prevailing wage at the outset of the project is an important priority and an important policy goal for you all here. So we don't want to urge this committee on any particular policy elements within the certain provisions of the bill, but again, want to draw a line and ensure that whatever is adopted by the this legislature, that it does provide that clarity at the outset. You may hear, obviously, different positions on different pieces of the bill, but I can tell you, at least for on behalf of the 242 cities we represent, if we have that certainty up front, that will be a marked improvement over current policy. Mr. Tosh talked about some of the confusion. We are concerned that the way this bill is drafted, that it may not achieve that bright line without some consideration about the definition of public work to accompany the exemptions incorporated in the bill with respect to public funds or the definition of public funds. So what we would ask is the ability to work with the sponsors of the bill. I think their goal is laudable. We agree with the intent, and we would like to work with them and work with you on ensuring that the concepts incorporated here in 2557 actually do provide that legal certainty for entities at the outset as to how public or how prevailing wage will be applied to public projects. Lastly, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for this committee's consideration tomorrow of a legislative concept that we're working with the Commissioner of Labor and Industries. He mentioned in his testimony the issue of predeterminations. We do have a piece of legislation that this committee will be considering tomorrow, and I'm hopeful that our association can work with the Bureau and together we can come forward with some agreements around those issues. So we also provide that where there is questions, we'll create a piece of legislation that is clear as possible. We know, however, there's always questions, and the predetermination process is a very good process to mitigate those at the outset of projects versus moving down the road and then finding you have a disagreement over time. So with that, I think we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I'm going to go to Randy first, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. As you know, Metro is the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area, and we are charged with managing the region's growth and development in a way that creates great communities and protects the region's quality of life. In practice, that generally is land use and transportation work. While we've historically done a lot, you know, we are a government that passes ordinances and regulations, but over time it's become clear that that's not enough to achieve what we're trying to accomplish. So the new strategies that we're using often involve investment of a very limited amount of public funds to achieve objectives that leverage private investment in our communities. So I'm going to take a couple of minutes here because what we do is a little bit different than what you've been hearing about so far today, just to explain what Metro's interest is and concern is about the legislation before you. But before I do that, I just want to say at the outset that the Metro Council fully supports the concept of, supports the requirement that public entities pay prevailing wage for the construction of public works. There's no ambiguity about that for the Council. They have no desire to participate in any project that's public or private that doesn't pay family wages. But some of the projects that we've been involved with raise questions about, you know, what they are, and so that's what I want to go into. So I want to start by asking, by answering the question of what the council's interest is in the issue of prevailing wage, talk about the bill a little bit, and then what we might suggest as some possible solutions to our concerns. And certainly, as many people have said today, would be very interested in participating in any discussions or work group or any further work that goes forward. One of the key urban development strategies that applies to the metro region is the region's long-range plan. It's called the 2040 growth concept. And one of the key strategies within the region's long-range plan, as I've talked to many of you about, is the development of centers. There we have about 40 designated town and regional centers throughout the Portland region. These are higher density areas of that combine housing, employment, retail, cultural and recreational activities, and they do that in a walkable environment that is well served by transit. The benefits of this kind of development include more efficient use of our limited supply of land, protection of farmland on the edges of the Portland region, which basically surrounds the region, greater transportation choices for the people that live in these areas and work there, better air quality, more effective and efficient targeting and coordination of public investments, basically we get more exciting and vibrant neighborhoods that maintain their high property values and create a sense of community and also attract businesses. Another way to look at this is that if we fail in our work of trying to stimulate the development of these centers, the alternative is that the region defaults to a development pattern of sprawling on the edge that no one in the region wants and that Oregon's land use program was created in part to prevent. But the development of centers that work, with a few exceptions in the Portland region, often involves higher costs than the market can sustain. You can get, the market can support the kind of development that's creating a Pearl District in Portland. It's a lot harder for the market to support the higher density vertical development that in a place like downtown Milwaukee or Gresham or other areas of the region that don't have quite the economics of South Waterfront or the Pearl District. So we're looking for creative solutions to help offset those added costs and create catalyst projects that will then bring those areas along. Often these solutions involve some sort of a public subsidy. Might be the need for structured parking, as many people have mentioned today. Might be firewall separation between uses. Might be providing an elevator, because when you get above a certain number of stories, you need an elevator. Might be providing some funds for seismic work, et cetera. So that's where our transit-oriented development program comes in. Metro has a program called the TOD program, Transit-Oriented Development, and we work with private developers to ensure that key projects are consistent with the region's center's development goals. We invest in projects that have the potential to spur more private development in the surrounding neighborhood and lead the market, thereby creating jobs and economic activity. Our participation often consists of land value write-downs. It might be a direct subsidy, some other mechanism. But it generally is limited to typically no more than 10 or 15% of the total project costs, often much less than that, even though that 10 or 15% of the project cost may or typically exceeds the threshold in this bill, $750,000. I just want to emphasize, these projects are privately built, they're privately owned, and they're used entirely by the private sector. There's zero public occupancy, typically. So they're private projects, but there's a subsidy involved to make them happen. The design improvements that we support generally ensure that the projects will enhance the local and the regional community, and the increased intensity of development helps us to avoid having to prematurely expand the urban growth boundary. But even with our participation, these projects often barely break even and generally offer, they certainly don't offer rich returns for the investors and developers. Without these, the participation that we provide, they generally don't pencil out at all. They may not be built, or if they are built, they'll be built in a way that fails to take advantage of the opportunities that we're trying to take advantage of for transit, supporting the transit system, using our efficient land, our land more efficiently, et cetera. So the question now is how would this bill affect these efforts? Well, our reading of the bill suggests that despite the exemptions that are provided in Section 1, it would fail to exempt from the requirements of the prevailing wage laws many, if not most, of the projects that are supported that have been supported by Metro's transit-oriented development program to date. What that would mean in practice, would the projects get built? I think there's a lot of uncertainty about that. But because these projects are usually pretty close to the line and only go forward through the layering of a whole series of incentives, tax abatements and subsidies and potential federal money, who knows what, then we have concerns that sweeping them into this category of non-exempted projects might be problematic. It's also worth mentioning that this bill may work at cross purposes with some legislation that you passed last session that's aimed at supporting the kind of development we're talking about. You passed last session Senate Bill 839, which extended a property tax exemption for transit-supportive multiple-unit development. You passed House Bill 2199, which expanded the applicability of the Vertical Housing Tax Credit. Both of those programs obviously aimed at supporting the exact kind of development that we're talking about. So this bill may be working at cross purposes to those pieces of legislation. So what do we recommend or hope that you would do? Well, one idea which doesn't seem to have a lot of traction in the discussion of the bright line here would be to modify the threshold to reflect some sort of a percentage of a project. We're talking about, it's a lot different to say $750,000 of a $3 million project than it is to say $750,000 of a $60 million project, which some of our projects that we're participating in do amount to that much in total investment. You might also consider an exemption for transit supportive development, which was at least on the table for the transit, what was it called, the Task Force on Public-Private Partnerships that met during the interim. We'd be happy to work with you on a discussion of that or the definition of that. Another idea might be to exempt the housing portion of a mixed-use project above a certain number of stories. So there are various, you might be able to combine some of these ideas, various possible ways to address our concerns. We'd certainly be happy to work with you on any of those. So I'll just end my testimony there. Thank you for the opportunity to raise these issues with you. They're a little bit different than the ones that have been presented today, and I'd be happy to discuss them more further with you.
Any questions? All righty then. Thank you very much. I have Victor Merced and Bob Gillespie, please.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Victor Merced. I'm the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm here today to support the clarification of prevailing wages as they apply to affordable housing and to ask the committee's consideration of some amendments we have to House Bill 2557. I'd also like to applaud the efforts of Mr. Shiprack and also Commissioner Gardner from Boley. I appreciate these efforts to clarify when prevailing wages should apply to affordable housing. This clarification is needed to overcome the current uncertainty in the affordable housing community surrounding affordable housing costs. And, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to read the remainder of my testimony. We have some amendments that I think are pretty straightforward. With me is Mr. Bob Gillespie, who is the Housing Division Administrator, and he can answer any questions on the amendments that we're submitting. To continue to build upon the worthwhile compromise efforts that have already been made, we are submitting amendments, as we mentioned, to address what we feel are some unintended consequences of House Bill 2557. And it is our hope, Mr. Chair, that a work group is established to further refine the language of this bill, and I will certainly offer any of my staff to work with the committee on any issues that arise out of this House bill. Members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity.
I was just going to answer any questions.
All right. Do we have any questions for these gentlemen?
Only to Mr. Chair.
Yes,
if I could
Representative Berger, please.
Thank them for their brevity.
Yes, very much. They stay an hour.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This is a public hearing. Does anybody else want to testify to House Bill 2557? Mr. Mannix, come on down.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem and a former member of this Legislative Assembly, served five terms in the House and a partial term in the Senate. And I'm working with the Salem Chamber of Commerce on issues relating to prevailing wage. And I've actually decided to testify extemporaneously simply as a reflection of what I've heard today. Representative Shiprack was chair of the House Labor Committee when I served with him in the 1989 session. The next session, Representative Durfler was chair of the House Labor Committee when I served with him on that committee. So let's just say I had history with both of them.
And you all got along, right?
We did. Okay. We did. The concern I just want to express, and it's a general concern, is that we tread cautiously with this issue today because of the complex side issues that arise, as you've heard from the testimony. I wasn't even aware of the problem that our friends from Metro may be encountering in terms of, say, a gigantic project where they're simply putting in an elevator to accommodate whatever needs they have for transportation, and all of a sudden the entire project becomes a prevailing wage project. That's an example of why the public hearing process is so important. It alerts us to these kinds of problems. The other problem that I think was alluded to earlier in testimony is the definition of project. I could come in front of you and come up with a pretty good idea about how I could redefine project under the current statute to incorporate miles of territory in a given community where they've got, you know, a hotel going up here, but the hotel doesn't work unless you have a garage over here, and that doesn't work unless you've got a restaurant over here, but you want to have some low-income housing across the way. And if they're all paying attention to one another and they're conversing with one another, does that make them one project? Then you then say that if any element of that had public funds, that the whole thing is a prevailing wage project. I'm simply placing this kind of issue in front of you and inviting some careful consideration of how we approach the definition of public project or public works, so that we don't trip over ourselves in an effort to clarify the law and find out that when we're done, it's more tangled than it was before. Thank you.
So if we build a casino and a hotel and a baseball diamond in Portland, anyway, I'll throw that one out there.
Baseball diamond.
Any questions for Mr. Mannix?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. All right. Since there's no other folks that want to testify today, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2557. And anything for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair. I just want to remind those in the following committee and committee members that we're meeting tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Hearing Room C, and that is a replacement of our usual Friday afternoon hearing.
That's right.
So tomorrow, just a reminder, tomorrow, 9 a.m., Hearing Room C.
Thank you, Teresa. Anything else? Well, if not, we'll stand adjourned.